The convention for talks is that the speaker doesn't introduce himself. Somebody introduces the speaker. And I said to the organisers, I don't want that. I said, I'll introduce myself, okay? But I don't actually want to introduce myself very much, except to say, because some of you know me, some don't, I am Vajrasadhu, okay? That's my Buddhist name. Vajrasadhu means, I've really got to look this up now, a wandering spiritual mendicant, in other words, like a sadhu, yeah? Like the Indian sadhus, with a fearsome energy, yeah? And I say fearsome because Vajrasadhu was one of the four fierce protectors of Padmasambhava, okay? So I'm part of the Tibetan tradition, and I usually take the form of, my emanation is usually as a snarling goat, okay? Snarling goat. So, no silly questions. Okay? I plan to talk with slides. And I asked Vajradevi on bended knee, I just said, look, you're asking me to cover the arts, right? So we're talking about literature, music, architecture, sculpture, and painting, right? The whole lot. I can't do that in the normal allotted time. So what I'd like to do, if you're happy, and you can object now, in which case I'll change it, is speak for 50 minutes, have a tea break, and then speak for another 20 minutes, okay? Because I don't like talks that go on for longer than an hour. I think they don't work. Okay? So that's my introduction, and that is the format. And I suppose the only other thing I want to say by way of introduction is that as I read my text today, much of which has been prepared for a series of talks which I've been giving to non-Buddhists in museums, in galleries, in places like that, so for a non-Buddhist audience, I realised that the Buddhist content wasn't probably strong enough, okay? It's hidden there. And believe you me, you can question me about this, I am very much a Buddhist, but the text is not explicitly about Buddhism, okay? It's about the relationship between the arts and what I call spiritual life, inner life, okay? At the same time, this first slide is the Buddha. This is the Buddha by the great Romanian modern sculptor Constantin Brancusi, and he sculpted this figure of the Buddha in the early 20th century, okay, in a very sort of African wooden style. I thought, you know, as soon as I saw it, I thought, actually, this is an African Buddha. I've never seen one of those before. But the reason I've put it up is that I'm only interested in the arts, actually. I mean, I love the arts, but I'm really interested in the arts from one point of view, and that is the extent to which it assists me and others towards some sort of vision of what I can only call human perfection. Okay? What we call enlightenment. And so it's a good starting point, that. And since I'm an order member going for refuge to our three jewels, I'm also interested in the extent to which the arts are and can be related to the Dharma, in other words, the way in which we realise this human perfection. And in the context of the arts, I call that actually beautifulness, truthfulness, and goodness. Yes, that's a very Keatsian kind of quotation there. And then thirdly, the third jewel, the Sangha. I think it's, I mean, for me, the Sangha is the place for where people exemplify their practice, okay? So there's plenty of opportunity in the arts for people to exemplify their practice in relation to a vision of human perfection and truthfulness, goodness and beautifulness. But I would also say, actually, before I got involved with the Sangha, much of my artistic endeavours were solitary. I did it on my own. And I think the one thing that has happened to me is that I've met quite a few friends in the Sangha. And for instance, one of my best friends was a professional singer, and is now chairman of the Amsterdam Buddhist Centre, and he became a very close friend of mine. We are close friends. And I just go back to sometimes, you know, we used to spend weekends just listening to like hundreds of recordings of Mahler and things like that together, which I would have never done without that friendship, you know. That's, so friendship does have a big role in appreciating the arts. I had quite a busy life, quite a busy career, so when I started to think about retirement, and in particular at the time of ordination, I thought to myself, what shall I do with my life? And I decided to adopt as a what I call personal myth, and you'll hear me talk about that, Sangharakshita's aesthetic mandala of non-production, and the articulation of arts and spiritual life within the context of his teaching. And five principles have underpinned this mission, which is a writing mission, because I'm writing about it, I'm talking about it, I'm running seminars and workshops on it. So the five principles are, this is Sangharakshita's emphasis, particularly in the religion of art, on self-transcendence, right, on the extent to which the arts assist one to transcend self, and in particular egotism, and to communicate values, yes, the extent to which the arts really do communicate values. This piece of art in front of it does communicate a certain uprightness, doesn't it, straight away. And also, actually, quite a lot of sort of, I can only call it, quite complex practices, because actually all these little shapes and so on are Brancusi's way of representing things like the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and this sort of thing. So he's kind of got it, I think, quite well. And he's got his lotus hat, do you see, and his eyes are in all directions, covering the whole of the universe. Okay? Those are the values. Secondly, as I just said, to support the arts in relation to spiritual practice. And I use the term affective, in other words, having an effect, as absolutely central to the way I'm thinking about the arts. So if it isn't actually transforming people, the way they think, etc., and it's not just an aesthetic, hedonistic exercise, which for most people it is, yeah, I don't see the point, actually. As a Buddhist, I don't see the point. Okay. So this is absolutely crucial to my message, and affective means purifying and self-transcending. Okay. Thirdly, drawing from the artists with the highest, broadest and most refined levels of consciousness. This is always very controversial, actually, because people say, well, what about, what's that group that my daughters love? Anyway, they love a big heavy metal group. And when I say to them, highest, broadest and most refined levels of consciousness, they say they don't do that, and they certainly don't. I'd say they're the lowest, coarsest and least refined forms of consciousness. Fourthly, I discovered after a 30-year career that I could no longer imagine. I did everything almost by rote and by committee report and things like that. And so for me, the arts are crucial in terms of getting that imaginative faculty running again. Okay, and the arts that I value are the ones that do that. Fifthly, really, it goes without saying, questing for new and relevant links between the Western arts, Western culture, and the Holy Dharma, which does come from the East and does have quite a strong cultural orientation on the East. So I'm going to read my text. Given that we're small, you can ask questions if you're burning to, but there will be a question and answer session in the second after the tea break. I start this journey of the inner eye. Oh, that's my title, by the way, the inner eye. Okay, so not the outer eye or the outer ear, but the inner, the emotional, the heart connections. With its combination of both external sense experience and internal mental experience, in the heart of London, if you can see this picture, in Trafalgar Square. This is because for me, and it will be different for almost everyone, London has been one of only four cradles of civilization, as I call them, where the visual arts, literature and music have continually exerted their affective potential, right, their potential to change my consciousness and my mind, its awareness, my thoughts about human affairs, and therefore my life, right? That changed my life. The others, besides London, have basically been Greece, Italy, and Vienna. Okay, so those are my personal cradles of civilization. There are lots more. And in many respects, the square demonstrates that across the arts, it is a combination of external sensory experience. When you're in there, there's lots of external sensory experience through seeing, hearing, and touching, an inner mental impact which combine to make works of art effective, resonant, relevant, and even redemptive. I haven't got the Nelson's column, but I start talking about it. The everlasting and imposing height of Nelson's column, stretching forever into a blue sky, the regal fierceness and monumental stillness of the huge bronze lions, the sparkling movement and transience of the fountains, the huge hard granite pavements, and the confident facade of the National Gallery, here's the interesting bit, designed quite astonishingly by the same architect as the person who designed this, yes? So we're sitting in a William Wilkins designed building, and that is a William Wilkins designed building.
Is this the same?
Same architect. Yeah. That's why I chose it. Never fail to impress by their physical scale and classical orderliness. The square, Trafalgar Square, has symmetry, consistency, and enclosure. But one never feels trapped as one can in St. Mark's in Venice or the Field of Miracles in Pisa, some of the really big set pieces like this. Because of its imagery of continual movement, freedom and escape, you know, there's so much movement in and out of it that you can never really feel totally enclosed. The square has symmetry, consistency and enclosure. Oh, sorry, I've covered this. It is for me, however, the myth of Nelson, right up on that column, long, tough voyages and countless battles won, which is at the root of the place's potency on my heartstrings, quite unusually, I think, and Byron's evocation, 'tis thus with people in an open boat, they live upon the love of life, and bear more than can be believed or even thought, and stand like rocks the tempests wear and tear. I mean, I do have this like deep respect for sailors and people particularly who went to battle and fought wars on the sea, because apart from anything else, as far as I can see, it's the most terrifying experience that human beings can go through. At the risk of a cricked neck, I try and fathom out Nelson's deeper nature. Naval might, arrogance, willpower, and our most courageous sailors' indomitable guts communicate themselves from his body language, facial features, and the bronze panels of the Battle of Trafalgar at the bottom of the column, one of which features his famous wounding and death at the Battle of Trafalgar. These mix with various of his personal myths: fighting with a polar bear, ignoring instructions by placing his telescope over his partially blind eye, flirting endlessly with beautiful women, and most of all for me, the walks of a few miles as a very young lad of about 5 or 6 years old, apparently, from his quiet Burn and Thorpe hamlet home to the North Norfolk coast to fall in love with the sea and ships somewhere near Wells, next to the sea. The 3 or 4 huge biographies of Nelson have their role and suggest other qualities: disciplined belligerence, serious frivolities, hypnotic will, argumentativeness, womanizing I've already touched on, art theft. He was a really major art dealer, and wherever he travelled he'd come back with the loot. proud pugnacity and consistent vanity. And the square's robustness and craggy ambitiousness are of the same stuff as the dutiful inner lives of those who have created a very mixed British history overseas, from Agincourt to Afghanistan. Its four sides, this is the square's four sides, communicate a moderate mix with the secular dominant over the religious. And until the 2012 Olympics, a very English shyness about civic pride. And I thought that was really quite amazing, this year's show of civic pride around the Olympics. Don't understand? We're a shy nation, the English, right? We're quite reticent and shy, except when we've won loads of gold medals at Olympic Games and that sort of thing. And I think that Trafalgar Square reflects that. To the east is the far from oppressive decorative Baroque, so we're getting further into other architecture, of St. Martin's, host to the wonders of the Academy of St. Martin's in the Fields, performing Bach and Mozart. That's its speciality. Its architecture's emancipated and timeless realism accompanies perfectly the universality of the Baroque music. And although considerably less appealing, the modernist mediocrity of South Africa House, which is the kind of embassy of South Africa next to St. Martin's, just down from St. Martin's in the Fields, is where I watched my friends at college throw stones at the embassy because they were convinced that such violence would remove the apartheid regime, as indeed it did, and support the mythologies starting to form around somebody called Nelson Mandela. Now, I just want to say, you know, I'm going into this because there's one way of looking on the square is physical, but actually by digging deeper and going inside it, into all the connotations of the place, one is beginning to open the inner eye. I laugh at the unexceptional architect William Wilkins, the chap who designed this building, his assured pastiche for the National Gallery, because it is just a funny mix of classical pastiche, is far more distinguished than the comfortable, commodious mediocrity of Robert Venturi's Sainsbury extension, where the shop and the restaurant are. According to the Prince of Wales, this saved us from a monstrous carbuncle. I have to laugh that the main pictures of the National Gallery, released by the National Gallery, now do not feature the Sainsbury Centre at all and are completely focused on that frontage by Wilkins. So obviously the people who sponsored that postmodern development are so ashamed of it that they don't feature it in most of their publicity. And this sort of commentary, for me, applies to much of postmodern art, with architecture, and I should call it computer-aided design because it's no longer what I called architecture when I studied it, doing tolerably well compared with postmodern painting and sculpture. So all these surges of memories influenced my likes and dislikes of the square, and I could go into lots and lots of reminiscences of New Year's Eve partying, and a friend of mine who used to introduce the Blue Peter program, I remember him climbing up there to get to the top of the Nelson Monument, Churchill's funeral, and so on. No scene setting here would be complete without the only suggestion of nature. Those insatiably greedy pigeons wheeling in over confident gangs through the air, or searching frenetically for food with their bobbing, gorgeous, coloured, iridescent necks. For me, they represent continuity and are worth comparing with the maws of the modern tourists visiting the square, as changes continue with the fourth plinth's recent gestures to postmodern British sculpture typifying contemporary relativism, and the actions diluting this archetypal centre of British military bravery in order to create a more relaxed meeting place. Hedonic pluralism is the zeitgeist, with some utilitarian impoverishment by exorbitant cafes, which Ruskin actually first spotted on one of his visits to Venice and said the place is going to become covered by expensive cafes, this in the 1850s. So Ruskin was quite a guy, really. Strange man. And it is through the arts in and around Trafalgar Square, a mix of external and internal influences, which create the mythologies in people's mental experience, which open up and inspire the inner eye. After 6 years of research, I've concluded that the inner eye experience does take a form close to a contemporary of Nelson, the German philosopher Hegel, in that there seems to be a continual effort to bridge and reconcile different opposites under tension. And I've just put the main ones up on the flowchart. So for instance, you know, actually, for me, the planning of Trafalgar Square is beginning to represent a combination of promotion of civilization and, a positive sense of history with a certain amount of barbarity and actually a coarsening of the sort of feel of the place as a result. This is all very traditional conservative stuff, but that's where I'm coming from in relation to the inner eye. And what is the inner eye? Well, faced with this question, my first instinct is to say, I don't know. And my second is that it is not to be spoken or written about using concepts. But that's simply not good enough when one's trying to write a book or give a talk. One can try Google and find that the inner eye or third eye comes from esoteric and mystical Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. So that's its origin. And it's seen as a gate leading to our inner experience and therefore very different and distinct from outer eye and optical experience. Did somebody want to say something? What?
The second sentence before. Can you just repeat that, what you just said?
One can try Google and find that the inner eye, that one?
Yes.
Or third eye comes from esoteric and mystical Eastern religions like Buddhism, yeah? And is seen as a gate leading to our inner experience, and therefore very different and distinct from outer eye sensory experience. Mystics, including some in the Tri Ratna movement, suggest it leads to higher states of consciousness, accessing mental imagery capable of transforming lives, and a non-dual experience in which viewer and viewed are completely unified. This facilitates deep inner connection and both profound joy and pleasure, grief and sadness. It is closely related to the Greek idea of theoria and seeing through by extended listening or extended gazing at ordinary phenomena, seeing through to the archetypes of beautifulness, truthfulness and goodness. I mean, I had a kind of experience like that earlier this week at the Royal Opera House during a Wagner opera, in which the principal god, Wotan, was being berated by his wife. And his wife was trying to tell him to do things differently to the way he planned to do them. And apart from the quality of the singing, which was exceptional at the time, I became so completely absorbed by this notion of woman telling man what to do, which has always been a big issue for me, that I became completely transfixed, actually, and did definitely go somewhere else, and my hair stood on end, and those sort of things. And I have to say that happens to me quite frequently. Happens to me a lot more frequently through the arts than it does through meditation. But it implies proper looking and seeing, hearing and listening, with a level of receptivity and an animistic affinity and unity with nature. Above all, it facilitates an experience of the arts which is genuinely effective and transforming, with a spiritually shocking, freeing and expansion of consciousness of high voltage, as in Rilke's famous encounter with an archaic torso of Apollo, which seemed to be saying, "Here is no place that does not see you. You must change your life. You must change your life." So art can suddenly face you with that sort of message. And that's a very Buddhist message, I might say. But these are concepts, and I want to rely on recognition of inner eye experience in the National Gallery to introduce my thesis. So, let's look at a few slides. Well, this is worth saying because this is the cover to Kandinsky, the artist's Concerning the Spiritual in Art. And it, not only is it interesting that Wilkins of the National Gallery designed this building, but this was actually published in 1912, so it's exactly 100 years ago, and this is its centenary. And he was really one of the first great artists to start going in depth to relationship between, in his case, colour, form and spiritual impact, inner impact. And he likened it a lot to music. He related colour, form, music, and the effect really on, let's call it, the heartstrings, yeah? Okay, so that's just by way of introduction. And I just brought this one in. This is one of my favourite paintings by Rembrandt, in which he shows the young Rembrandt facing this huge, ominous canvas. And I've only put it in, oh, and incidentally, look at the state of the place. It's all peeling and obsolescent. And the main point is that the artist's terrified, right? Actually, if you look at it, he's really frightened. And I don't want anybody to think that, you know, really getting into the arts is totally a pleasurable experience. For me, it really has its ups and downs. And it can be both an extremely frightening experience and a very challenging experience. And it certainly took Rembrandt, who I rate as the greatest painter ever, into areas again and again and again where he'd never been before. Now, that as a metaphor for spiritual life is a good one. And in many ways, the reason I have this deep feeling for artists is that I actually think, like Nelson, they've continually had to have the guts to do it. Yeah. Actually, I sometimes think that religion and spiritual life is relatively easy compared with that. And then the other thing I wanted to introduce, this is from the Sistine Chapel, the communication between God and who was it? Adam. That's right, God and Adam. Just as a symbol of the fact that, for me, the arts and the inner eye are only awakened where there is communication between, let's call it the human world, that's our world, and what I'd call divinity or some much higher form or vision or higher level of consciousness, all right? So that's what's exciting. It's when that starts to happen that my hair starts to stand on end, okay? And here we get, I've got two pictures of this, I don't quite know why, but it is interesting. I much prefer this one. Do you want to go back on that just to show you? It just shows the impact of light. And anyway, so I'm going to talk about this now. I'm going to talk about two paintings in the National Gallery, and I'm just going to illustrate the way I look at paintings, trying to draw out the inner eye. So this is Piero della Francesca's Baptism of Christ, not the sort of thing you'd expect to see in a Buddhist centre. And to me, it immediately suggests, firstly, a very strange combination of what I call a disciplined and planned orderliness. This is not a chaotic picture. And secondly, a potential for what I call a wonderful chaos arising from an unprecedented spiritual event or experience. Because the baptism is a very strange experience itself, yes? Purification through water poured on the head and so on. And then the second thing that's happening is this is actually the River Jordan and it's dried up, which in those days was extraordinary and these days isn't so extraordinary. And I'm actually working in the Middle East at the moment where you've got people like Turkey and Syria and Jordan fighting for the water from the River Jordan and it gradually being threatened with drying up. So there you are. Shift in consciousness. It's an awesome demonstration of solid geometry because Piero della Francesca was and still is one of the foremost experts in solid geometry and an abstruse belief or faith in something other. Yeah. When I say it's very orderly. I just want to demonstrate this. The tree and the other tree just to the right of John the Baptist. You see the tree just above the guy who's getting his kit off? Yeah, you can do. Yeah. What?
Yeah.
Anyway. Those two are two verticals, okay? They're two definite verticals. And then you've got a number of horizontals across this picture structuring it, which the most obvious one is where the white dove is, yes? So in a way, actually, this picture is structured on a grid. It's actually quite a lot like Piet Mondrian, you know, the famous Dutchman with his black lines and his yellow, red and blue panels. But it isn't, it's Piero della Francesca. So my sense of it is that it has that orderliness almost arising from the maths, from the fact that this man was a mathematician, but he was also a mystic. Okay. He straddles ethics and hedonism in Christ, the Baptist, and the angels, and provides strong symbols of a starrier hidden world, whose blend of rational discipline and weirder unconscious irrationality avoids moribund, spiritless materialism. The picture has luminous spheres, three-dimensional skies and clouds. The placement of his planes and subtle handling of light are extremely telling. And here's a bit of literature that comes in. Marcel Proust, the famous French writer, gave a fantastic commentary on this painting, which I'll quote. Pierrot's great merit lay in containment of the snaky meanderings of functional line within the inexorable pipelines of perspective, so that properly irrigated, the vast fields of colour might all burst into flower again. And thus was the neutrality of lively Gothic hues raised to coloristic harmony and unity. So that's one creative artist talking about another creative artist. Its understated but dramatic visualization suggests several potential levels of both transformation and moral purification. The white dove, the delightful vulnerable beauty of the angels, the astonishing clouds in an infinite sky, the baptism itself, the man undressing, the visiting kings, they're coming up at the back there if you can see them on the right, and the less civilized peasants working in the fields in the mountains behind, are indicative of different levels of awareness and knowledge of religious experience. The naturalism suggests an historical event, while Christ and the Baptist's unbearable lightness of being implies a transcendent myth. Upward pointing trees, mountains, and the curved top of the frame around a light blue celestial sky are, and I don't use this other than culturally, heavenly. Okay? Christ and the long-haired, snaky-curled Baptist are strangely refined. The four middle ground kings approaching to witness the event with their colourful oriental robes reflected in the water, you see just below the chap who's taking his clothes off, especially the one with outstretched arms, suggest anxious amazement. Last but not least, there are those three angels on the left with their angelic white gold hair, who have flown in as witnesses. Two are impassive, and the middle younger angel rather shocked and just slightly perplexed. With their quite thick ankles, naturally folded garments of solid colours, primitive ornaments, and rustic wreaths of leaves and roses, they've gone beyond just being country girls. They've gone above being country girls. Their subtle body language supports one another. Tranquility, puzzlement, and different levels of spiritual experience. And they are a completely united little sangha or spiritual community of the early Renaissance. The painter draws the viewer into an unusually unified paradise with an interconnectedness of everything in the picture and each item contingent upon the whole. The deepest Buddhist insight, nothing exists in itself. I can draw that from this picture, that there are all these separate elements which are completely interconnected. And extended contemplation can lead the viewer to link the tree, the central figures, the distant city towers, and immediate surrounding parched rural land, and with the light blue luminous skies unifying the whole scene. I'll move on to another one. In fact, I'm going to move on quite quickly here. This actually isn't the picture in the National Gallery because I couldn't find a slide for it, but it's very close to Caravaggio's painting called Boy Bitten by a Lizard. And it's a very camp young man being bitten by a lizard, covered in flowers and fruit and that sort of thing, right? This is actually from the same period in the Uffizi of Bacchus, but it's got the same sort of qualities for the inner eye. Indeed, its strangeness is a character of all works of art for the inner eye, because this I'd describe as a strange painting. It has strangeness, and strangeness is a quality for the inner eye. With its camp, loose youth, afflicted by indignation and pain, it is a particularly poignant symbol of the infinite capacity of human beings to initiate suffering as a result of their insatiable and self-centered appetite for pleasure and achievement. And there's a whole series of pictures, early pictures by Caravaggio, of this type, which I can only say I correlate completely to things like the Buddhist Four Noble Truths and the source of suffering, and the conditions in which suffering grows and the conditions in which suffering reduces. Caspar Friedrich covers death, mortality, immortality, and the afterlife in his Winter Landscape, which is a very small, highly resolved and dramatic image featuring the archetypal wanderer facing the abyss of his own death. Just want to point him out. Do you see the rock in front of the trees? There's a chap sitting against those, right? So what you've got is you've got his crutches are left in the snow, right? You see them? And if you follow the crutches, you've got a guy lying against the rock in the midst of the snow. So he's propped against a boulder before a large crucifix against the tree, yeah? Rising up from a small grove of mature snow-capped firs. He's cast off his two crutches in two separate incidents and lost his way or run out of his last drop of energy, or both. The scene evokes myths of disability healed by a miraculous faith and renunciation of earthly existence for the spiritual life, because of the Gothic church at the back, I guess. The peripheral placing of the church, nevertheless, reflects Protestant material. Friedrich the painter came from North Germany and was brought up very much in the Lutheran tradition, and therefore seems to suggest a commentary on the direct relationship between man and divinity, in which the painter doesn't seem to be too impressed by the church institutions, and he's placed the church very much in the background and to the side, and suggested that actually the fate of this chap in the snow is going to depend on his spirit and his inner life, not in any institutional responses. So the fir trees are as religious as the church. Nature is placed above formal religious rites and rituals as ends in themselves. Redemption stems from discarding religious formalism for nature's potential and promise, in the unlikely event that he can continue his journey. On the one hand, the wanderer has ended his wandering and found his salvation. On the other, a disabled individual will freeze to death in an icy waste of a wholly unsympathetic and hostile nature. Typically of Friedrich, both afterlife and nihilistic futures and the artist's oscillation between these extremes are suggested. The reason I've featured it is here is a painter that continually oscillates between the eternal soul and an afterlife and absolute annihilation on death and nothing after that. And of course, that the central teaching, I think, in fact the first sermon of the Buddha, was the middle way teaching, which really said, you know, mankind needs to go down the middle of those two extremes, or all sorts of implications will follow. And finally, in this quick review of the National Gallery, and then we'll break, and some similarly romanticized existential material focused on the essential character of human existence, in turn as, and judging from a recent poll, the nation's favourite picture, The Fighting Temeraire, and the role of impermanence, transience, and intense frustration. The Fighting Temeraire, this is the big ghostly boat, glides gently through a magically still and mirror-like sea in a maritime funeral cortege. So this is a funeral procession for boats. The almost imperceptible movement of this giant, drawn by one of the artist's favourite steam paddle wheel tugboats, is marked by the gentlest ripples bringing out as emotional response to smoky energy like Ruskin's own apocalyptic warnings about the Industrial Revolution, or an affectionate acceptance of technical change. This hearse-like procession, hearse is again a funeral procession, this hearse-like procession shows this Battle of Trafalgar, so there's a link with the Trafalgar Square, veteran, with its slim ghostly white masts and furled sails as the putative corpse. All sorts of light effects, from a highly symbolic flaming setting sun, the tugboat chimney, the shadows on the reflected sea, with the gradations of a master of shadow, almost as good as Leonardo. Shadows lead to a fuller sense of the brilliancy of his light, like transparent, palpitating veils, with the darkest of them, a dark grey, imbued and penetrating with that glowing light. A barge on the right-hand side of the painting, you see it just down below the sea? Sails... Where am I? Swimming. A barge on the right-hand side of the painting sails under the glow of the setting sun in deep shadow. It is very much the working boat contrasted with the redundant Temeraire. A hulk floats on the horizon just behind, on the right-hand side, yeah, of the Temeraire, floats on the horizon in marked contrast to the sailing ship to its left with its full sails and square rigging. And the Temeraire's end, like ours, coming on any old working day with the flag which braved the battle and the breeze no longer owning her. The painting made Turner very popular as the creator of a furnace-like blaze of light making the river glow with its effulgence and typifying the glories of the Temeraire as my darling. The old warrior being tugged away to die alone in silence. So for me, these four paintings in the National Gallery suggest that behind the self-centred hedonism and consequent suffering of Caravaggio's boy, the exhaustion of Friedrich's wanderer's willpower, the towing of the Temeraire to the scrapyard, and the centrality of purification, as in the baptism, these are the essentials in the human condition. And there's so much more in the National Gallery. This is four out of, well, several thousand, actually, several thousand paintings. So, that's my break. Should we break there, have a cup of tea, and then come back?
So, I took you into Trafalgar Square, basically to introduce you to the six arts. Yeah, we covered music, we covered architecture, we covered sculpture, we covered pictures, and I put in a bit of poetry from Byron. That was the whole idea of that, yeah? But it was also to say, I bet you experience, like I usually experience, Trafalgar Square as basically a physical entity. And there's a hell of a lot more to it than that. And the inner eye is the thing that is going to open you up to that, yeah? And it's only through a certain amount of effort, dare I say it, that inner eye will open up and take you behind the physical and the sensory, okay? In the second bit, and I'm going to be very quick here so that we don't end up too late and not allow questions, I'm just going to give you two or three examples of what I call the affective potential of the arts, okay? So this is the potential of the arts to affect human beings, human psyches, ways of being, levels of consciousness, and so on. And I'm going to end with two more little masterpieces. I'd love to do music. You know, actually my favourite art of the arts is music, and I would have given you late quartets of Beethoven and the Ring Cycle of Wagner and Kate Bush and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Miles Davis and all the others, yeah? Okay, pardon? But, well, I just don't have anything to play it with, and I don't see the point. You know, the point is you've got to experience the art, so... I mean, I could do it just on music. And in a way, I haven't said that much about literature, but I will say something about literature in a minute. So, let's just do two examples, because I've got four, of the affective potential of the arts. This chap, I'll just, if you can see the screen... Do you know who that is? Do any of you know who that is? Because actually nobody has had a bigger effect on the way we look at things, in my opinion. And that is John Berger, who wrote the famous book... What was it called? Something and Seeing, wasn't it? Looking and Seeing. And he basically said it's the end of art, now that we've got reproductions and cameras and this, that and the other... The whole basis of art is going to change. He was the one that wrote about that revolution in the perception of art. But I just want to read you what I've written about a little essay that he wrote about his own experience, which I think is, for me, a really resonant example of the effective potential of the arts. Because actually, I've very often ended up completely destroyed by meetings and bureaucracy in the centre of London, and then gone to the National Gallery, right? Absolutely done in, yeah? No consciousness whatsoever, you know. The light's on, but there's nothing inside. And gone to the National Gallery and actually come out of that state of being in a much better state. So, in his essay, this is Berger's essay entitled The Production of the World, John Berger wrote of becoming wearied of a transnational institute cultural conference in Amsterdam, right? So we must all have that experience of going to meetings and discussions and this, that and the other, and ending up brain dead, heart dead, you know, just... His experience of his own exhaustion with all the clever talking involved forced him to actually leave the room of this transnational conference that he'd probably been paid tens of thousands to attend. He tried a cold shower, coffee, not drinking coffee, and nothing worked. And over a couple of hours, he thought he was going through. He did have a few nervous breakdowns as well. You can see that this man certainly had, you know, he felt his feelings. None of them worked. So he decided in Amsterdam, as one does, to visit the Van Gogh Museum, where he was immediately shocked, calmed and rejuvenated by the therapeutic power of the paintings. I'll just get up the painting that particularly got him going. Not surprisingly. Oh. Okay, can you see that? You probably know that, The Starry Night by Van Gogh. I mean, I think it's a great thing that it was that got him going, because, you know, when you look at that, it's kind of difficult to think of not getting going on that. Anyway, he attributed
his sudden calm and rejuvenation completely to the therapeutic power of the paintings. He attributed this to the consonance of Van Gogh's and his own depression, and recalled Sartre's nausea and an offer by an artist in a small gallery of an entire world in the form of a reply. I like that. An entire world in the form of a reply to a particular kind of anguish. A salvaging of reality, an imaginative construction of reality behind cultural cliches, and a labour of existence as constituting reality in the stars in Van Gogh's wondrous Starry Night. So, you know, here we've got art as therapy, right? If you're looking for art as having affect, an affective art, here is an example, really, of art as psychological therapy, almost, yeah? And certainly that's been my experience. I've been moved from total depression to, you know, reasonable contentment several times by the arts. Then a second example. I can play with this till the cows come, actually. Do we know who this is yet? First one to guess who this is. And actually my proudest and greatest time in my professional career was when I worked for this man. Because this man came to me and said, "Hey John, I've got these lovely big outdoor sculptures near Bishop Stortford and they're going to fly planes all over them. And I want you to be my planning consultant who tells the airport authority at Stansted that they can't fly these blooming great planes over my huge outdoor sculptures." So, who's this?
I'm afraid to say something wrong.
This is Henry Moore.
Yeah.
Right, so this is Britain's greatest modern sculpture, probably the greatest modern sculpture. So, there he is, tough little Yorkshireman who is definitely seen as the greatest. And now I'll show you the piece that got him going, which I was with only 2 weeks ago, and which oops, done it again. Can you see? I'll try and make it a bit bigger. No. Anyway, you can see it's mother and child, right? So it's Madonna and Christ in Pisa, and this is what you get on Henry Moore. Then in sculpture, there's the impact of the Giovanni Pisanos in Pisa and Pistoia on no less than Henry Moore. First in 1925, when he struggled to admire them high up on the facade and top of the baptistry, and the impossibility for him as a sculptor, to feel the true three-dimensional face-to-face relationship. Because we were up on the baptistry, right? Right up at the top of this really high building, okay? But then, after the war, however, when they were taken down to the museum because they were very worried about their erosion, Moore was bowled over by the tremendous, and this is his quote, "tremendous dramatic force, the urgency of human communication suggested by the thrusting forward necks and their potent gestures to give the message, thereby providing absolute presences," that's quite a good phrase, "absolute presences, and portraying human feelings and character to express profound truths. The sculptor's articulation," this is Victor Pisano, "of the 16 parts of the human body that a sculptor thinks about,
from the inside out rather than the outside in, right? So we're talking inner eye here. Suggests deep philosophical understanding of human nature, a future tragedy in this case, the contradictions, troubles and worries inside people's heads, and electrical charges in the air. So Moore is saying this sculpture, Giovanni Pisano, who is 13th century, thought about form from the inside out rather than the outside in. He'd got his 16 body parts, but he'd also got a catalogue and a library of emotional intelligence, right, from which he worked from the inside out. This was no art for art's sake, but an art and an anatomy to express philosophy and existential predicaments with the power to live from the inside, requiring you to let it out. This is Moore's phrase, Henry Moore's phrase, requiring you to let it out and lead to an understanding of life and people. Okay. So that's my second example of a great artist, an important aesthet. And I could have gone on. There's just one other I want to show you, just to show. Oh, well, actually two others, just to say. So this is, do you know who this is, anybody? No? He's called Brian McGee. He's a philosopher. He wrote a very lovely book called Confessions of a Philosopher. And every time I go to the opera house, to Wagner, like I did earlier this week, he's always there. And what he basically says is that had he actually just had academic philosophy to deal with, and he's a very good philosopher, expert on Schopenhauer and a number of others, and very, 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 very good books on some of the Greek philosophers, so he's a good academic philosopher. He says, had it not been for Wagner, he'd have basically throttled himself a long time ago. Yeah? His academic career, though deeply kind of, you know, high level, is also deeply frustrating and doesn't answer his life in the way that an experience of Wagner at the opera does. Okay. And likewise, this chap, where is he? I've got him somewhere. Have I lost him? No, there he is. Anybody know? I'm terrible, aren't I? This is, I think, probably still, he's not far from dying actually, but he's probably the greatest writer and critic of literature alive. He's called Harold Bloom. He's a professor of literature in New York, in America. And you can see from the face, you know, there's quite a lot of existential stuff, isn't there? And he says that, you know, his life would have been miserable, completely miserable, and he really means it, without Shakespeare. You know, so these are people who, you know, have read everything or heard everything or whatever, have chosen their focus in the arts, and it's given them existential solidity and purpose, basically. I'm going to finish just going back to this chat. And I would have given you quite, if there'd been time, I would have given you quite a catalogue of examples of how effective the arts can be on people's inner lives, okay, by these sort of examples. Let's just finish with one further masterpiece. It'd be great to reduce the light a bit. Anyway, can you see? This is one of three late Rembrandt self-portraits, which I, you know, my likes and dislikes don't really matter, but I consider this to be the height of painting. Yeah. I said right at the beginning that, and this was very much referring to Sangharakshita's teaching, that actually there's a hierarchy of arts, and to be right at the top of this hierarchy, or to be high up even in that hierarchy, there must be an expression of values, right? So they must, art must have a significant content of positive values for it to be awarded high level in the hierarchy of arts. And this painting, which again is in the National Gallery, is probably one of the best examples of what I would call expressing stoicism, right? So expressing patience and forbearance, and what we call in Buddhism the dealing with the worldly winds of things going right and then things going wrong. And in particular in dealing with life's inevitable disappointments and disillusionments when you get, in his case, he'd lost his two great loves, his two great, one wife and one girlfriend. He'd lost three children through illness. He'd got very rich and very popular with the Dutch monarchy and then lost it all. He played the art market like I used to do and lost all his money. And he went to the bankruptcy court and was declared bankrupt. Right? So he'd really had the full whammy. And I'll just read what I've written about. Actually, it's about the other self-portrait in Edinburgh, but as I discovered on a particular van run, actually, for Windhorse, right, which is the business here, which I used to work for, bumping into Rembrandt's surprisingly small and late self-portrait with Berry, this was in Edinburgh, can also be a deep and effective shock to the system, and even a spiritual turning point, if contemplated patiently rather than normal few seconds. I spend time in galleries actually clocking how long people watch paintings. The answer's basically, if you're lucky, 2 or 3 seconds, maybe 8. In this case, I actually stood in the Edinburgh case in front of the painting for 50 minutes. I was so shocked. And I suddenly noticed that actually there were two members of staff on either side of me. And I said, what's going on, you know? They said to me, we're a little bit worried about you. We think you've been looking at this painting so long that you might want to vandalise it. You know, that's where we've got to. There's so much in that look and in the presence of mortality which initiates such a strong meeting between ageing painting, subject and viewer relating to disappointment, stoicism, and here's the value, integrity, during tough times in career or family life or whatever. And the ringing quality of his presence arises from the acuity of the painter's self-knowledge and the depth of painting of his own approach to old age. For him, this is Rembrandt, the mundane worlds of trade, domesticity, conventional morality, and ambition now seem of little interest and are being, by a vision of transcendence, making him seem monumental, despite the work's modest size and very soft, subtle rendering of light and shadow. It was painted about 10 years before he died and followed bankruptcy, disposal of his assets, and a considerable loss in his artistic reputation. Leads one to speculate on whether he would have reflected both when wealthy and as he lost it all on Calvin's wealth as the mother of extravagance. For he had been extravagant and greedy at the auctions where the goods and paintings were bought.
which bankrupted him. There was nothing apologetic or ascetic in the Rembrandt house in line with Dutch joy in their prosperity in the 1660s. And in Sharma's Embarrassment of Riches, Sharma gives evidence that Amsterdam's houses, despite all this teaching of Luther and Calvin and all those people who they followed, were packed with priceless artworks reflecting strange balances between greed and godliness. Doubtless Rembrandt's resulting bankruptcy followed a decade of reckless fearlessness and little, if any, thrift. But the self-portrait suggests the ephemeral nature of affluence and a rather Protestant space in relation to boom and bust, including the fall of Icarus, who is featured in the decoration of Amsterdam's bankruptcy courts. In addition, with three children and his beloved wife Saskia buried in the early 1640s, the portrait reflects personal loss, consciousness of infant mortality, nightmares, fears of cot deaths, Christian incredulity in relation to God's will, and a cathartic coping must have all featured in his inner life. Indeed, a very tough cookie like Nelson, whose losses had not dented his individuality, immaculately rendered through virtuoso painting of hair and velvet hat. Grace arises from disgrace, self-possession from dispossession, and avoidance of shame puts him above shame with only a tinge of self-pity. Physical weight combines with inner weightlessness and solid mass with his lightness of being, arising from acceptance of just getting old. And seeing himself marginalised, he jettisons ambition until, with his lover Hendrikje's death, he withdraws to the Rozengracht, which is where our Amsterdam Buddhist Centre is, like an old snail to live in shadows like the owls. Deeply effective, pretty redemptive, through a demonstration of humility after humiliation and stoic integrity in adversity. And again, I could have said something similar about King Lear in Shakespeare and all these other examples. I think I'll stop there. I was going to say the one thing I haven't covered is my love of rock and pop, right? So yeah, I'm not just an elitist, you know. I've kind of gone into that as well. And I could have given you equal depth promotions to the inner eye of Hendrix and Bob Dylan and Kate Bush and so on. You know, I will not accept that this is elitist conservatism and I'm putting down things that are more popular and have a broader appeal, okay? So that'll do. Any questions? You're right.
And there aren't many things I do that for.
I agree with you about Rembrandt.
But a lot of the other stuff you talk about, you know, I'd rather you stare at me than put me to a
Wagner opera. You know, almost literally.
Mm.
So, you know, whereas I understand that it's not necessarily about the leaders.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on
individual responses to different things.
Hmm. Taste and likes and dislikes and
yeah.
what's below, what's beyond that.
I mean, yeah, what's your thoughts on the place of those things?
Well, when I was first taken to, you know, my father was a profound Wagnerian, right? And he was, you know, he was brought up in Vienna and he was really, he'd really seen it from the inside and he'd lived it. His family had lived it. He'd been in the culture. So I was taken to opera from a very early age, and I can't say that I particularly took to it straight away. I must say that quite early on, the music, actually Wagner's music, got into me, right? A level of kind of, you know, that, you know, you might respond to something completely different to. And there's nothing, you know, I'm not saying I'm right and you're wrong. On the other hand, I've done so much work now on countless trips to the opera and countless reviews and countless criticism and so much reflection on the personalities and the relationships between the people. You know, this thing that I was talking about this thing a few days ago, in which basically a wife who'd been you know, the husband hadn't been faithful, right? So husband hadn't been faithful, wife is aggrieved, and she's complaining and really getting at husband, right? Now that is a big situation, right, in life. There's a lot of that going on, you know? And I just feel that Wagner actually completely and utterly gets at every layer of that relationship, in the same way as Rembrandt gets at every layer, right? That painting is painted on about 40 layers of paint. Right? And it's like, it's almost like, just layers and layers. And somehow Wagner's depth of the layering, for instance, of that relationship that I'm talking about, does make me say that it's got universal value and significance, and it's worth studying, you know, it's worth going into, rather than, and I, you know, again, I can see this one, I don't like it and I'm not going to go anywhere near it. I mean, actually, the purpose of the talk, in a way, is to say, if you want to open the inner eye, you're probably going to have to go to places you've never been before, simply on the basis of taste. That's all. I think that's a fair, yeah. Does that answer, begin to answer?
Yes.
And I mean, for sure, and you know, you and I, we kind of know this one, for sure spiritual life has to take you to areas you've never been before, or you don't change. You know, and our whole teaching of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth and so on, well, the same applies to going into the arts. And I've struggled, for instance, with modern classical music for 20 years. And now I've become extremely keen on Ligeti and Messiaen and those people. And it wasn't easy.
Right.
And it did involve some application and some research. I mean, the thing with, it was strange with me and Messiaen. I couldn't stand Messiaen. And then suddenly I heard a program in which they were talking about the fact that Messiaen was a fanatical bird watcher, which I am. And suddenly I realised that his music was full of birdsong. And that got me going, and I thought, oh, I'll give this more time. Before I knew it, I was hooked by Messiaen, not just the birdsong.
I had a similar experience with the quartet to the end of time. A friend of mine, a musician, recommended it. I listened to it and hated it. Because he was my friend, I kept listening to it, still hated it. And then I read about what he was trying to convey, what Messiaen was trying to convey, and a door opened, and I could listen to it with a different ear almost.
I mean, another one, just going back to Wagner, you know, I'm actually very hooked on the Batman films. Okay, these last two Batman films, I've been riveted by, right? But I have to say, they're incredibly superficial dramas about, you know, good and evil, compared with The Ring Cycle. You know, the layers in The Ring Cycle compared with the Batman trilogy are just unbelievable. And actually, my experience of good and evil at that sort of, you know, gang level is that it actually is terribly layered and very elegant. No, very elegant, difficult, refined structures to be drawn to go through before you really understand it and can do anything about it. Whereas Batman, it's just basically battle, isn't it? So, and if you've got these fantastic motorbikes and things like that and you fly up in the air, you can deal with it. But actually, reality ain't like that. And Wagner's more like reality, I think, you know. And I should say the other thing is I'm not going to defend my likes and dislikes, but I am going to defend, and I've chosen these deliberately, what I call art that appeals through its universality, through the fact that it really does deal with something that we all have in common, every one of us, you know, right across the earth. And we do our metabhavna to all living beings. Well, these pieces of work are for all living beings. I do. I do. Don't ask me. Yeah. Well, I believe in, you know, actually, I'd have to say six canons: a music canon, a literary canon, a sculptural canon, a painting canon, and a poetry canon. Something like that. Yeah. Yeah, Bloom's book is, you know, the Bloom that I showed, the literary canon's very good. Very controversial, and you can say, why did he leave certain things out, and why did he include certain things? But it's a worthwhile exercise. And without it, you have no real standards, actually. Oops. We done? It's not too late. Okay.
Pardon? I had some questions, but they were in between, and when you talked, and I forgot them. So.
Okay, well, you can ask me as I pack in or something, if you remember them.
Really good.
Okay, good, thank you.